Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. Mm-hmm. And on this program, I talk about the evolution of change, how we are perceiving other realities, how our awareness of the environment around us and who we are as beings are changing and opening up to new ideas and new possibilities. And along those lines, one of the people that have inspired me the most in her reporting and her research in her books is Linda Moulton Howe, and she'll be the guest tonight. And I just love the perspective and the uniqueness and the originality of where she's coming from. So welcome, Linda.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm very much looking forward to being with you and Fionn's in October. I think it's the third weekend in New York, where I will be presenting a kind of synthesis after three decades of trying to get to the bottom of what our government and other governments know about non-human intelligences interacting with this planet that includes so many facets, ranging from animal mutilations to the human abduction syndrome to crop formations, embedded mathematical languages, symbols, a self-activating software for self-activating machines, and how that is becoming so much clearer now as we are moving into the 21st century, and that I think that the self-activating software and self-activating machines are a crucial part to the mystery of the phenomena that has persisted really in Earth's skies, I personally think, for 5,000, 10,000 years or longer.
Well, we'll talk about that, but I do want to say, for people interested in seeing Linda in New York, Linda Moulton Howe in New York, that will be October 22nd, 2011, and that is a conference that the Friends of the Institute of Noetic Science, or FIONS, F-I-O-N-S, will be hosting, and that's the website fions.org to find out more information, and that'll be from 1 to 5. It's very reasonable. We expect to have a great crowd because Whitley Strieber as well as Richard Dolenz, and these three people are really, for me, the leaders of research as well as experiences in Whitley's case of this phenomenon that Linda will be talking about, ET's time travel and self-activating machines. So, Linda, I'm not sure what you actually mean by self-activating machines.
Okay. I'll give kind of a very rapid overview, beginning with the phenomena that I encountered in pastures in 1979 for the first time in my career when I was director of special projects for the CBS station in Denver. And I had been there from 78, 10 years before 78. I had graduated with a master's degree in communication from Stanford University, where I made documentary films with the Stanford Medical Center and the Stanford Linear Accelerator for my master's degree, and had gone on into news at KNBC television in Los Angeles, where my beat was largely science and environmental affairs, and I was asked to produce a live TV program each week. We were from in different locations, Sacramento, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., and that reinforced that my beat was, again, in issues of science and environmental matters and sometimes medical that would affect the California audience. And I was married at the time, and my husband went to Harvard to get an MBA, and when I was in Boston, I was hired to be the producer of all of their medical programming and later science programming at the ABC station, yet again reinforcing that everything that I was doing from my master's degree at Stanford on was all grounded in the hard disciplines of medicine, science, forensic evidence, and I basically spent those 2 years in and out of all of the major medical centers in Boston, from Harvard to Mass General and so forth, producing medical programs every week, and I was also working with scientists on. It's so interesting now, looking back, Alan, that one of the interviews that I did for television in Boston in what would have been approximately the 74, probably around 74, 75, 76, somewhere in there, was with McElroy at Harvard. He was one of the first atmospheric physicists who was trying to develop a rudimentary computer program having to do with this question. If carbon dioxide continues to enter the atmosphere at the rate that they were measuring it then at Harvard, what will happen to the climate of this Earth? And I'll never forget talking with that man so many years ago with his prediction of everything that has come to happen, and that we are now in a period of global climate change, whether you want to argue about persistent warming or not. And that is all of the background to say that my entire professional career from then to this day has always been grounded with scientists and medical people, environmental investigators, always. Well,
that's why your research is so valuable, because it's not out there. It's grounded in facts that can be related to, if people choose to look at it, with science and with the real world, as it's been called, you know.
Right, and as the New York Times and the Washington Post and every journalist worth their salt for decades has demanded, you always try to get a minimum of 3 eyewitnesses, if you can, on anything that happens from an airplane accident to whatever, a fire. And I have used the same journalistic principles that the New York Times used in my career. I am always trying to work with scientists on forensic evidence, and if I can get 1 eyewitness, that's better than 0. If I can get 3, that's ideal. And in this tough world of unexplained phenomena that I am convinced now is related to non-humans interacting with the planet, it gets even tougher because people are more afraid of other people criticizing them than just about anything else. So jumping back to Boston, the whole background and context of my work and leaving Boston and going to Denver to take over the directorship of special projects at the CBS station was in a move with my then husband, who was moved to Denver in a corporation he was working for, Time Inc. And I took over doing director of special projects work, which included producing 4 documentaries a year on average, doing live studio programs as I had been doing in Los Angeles at KNBC, and doing live updates in news on the news set. So it was in that context that I had been working and producing at Channel 7 KMGH-TV. Up through the summer of 1979, I had won a National Emmy Award nomination, had received multiple Emmys, Ohio State Awards, and I'm only saying this to stress that by the fall of 1979, I had already produced so much for television. I had won so many of the so-called major journalistic awards that when a crew that I was working with, the sound guy, had just come off of a shoot for 2020 in New York. It was brand new back then, if you recall. And he said, Linda, we were at lunch one day on a production I was doing that had nothing to do with phenomena. He just, we would hire crews who were available, and he was a great audio guy and was based in Denver, and he would go off and do stuff. And so I had hired him to work with me on a project. And we were at lunch, and he said, man, you know, I just came off of a long shoot for ABC. It's called 2020. And he said, we were out in the hinterlands of Rancholands, and there are all these strange animals, and they're dead, and there's no blood, and there's no tracks, and they all have the same excisions. And, Linda, I couldn't keep the battery belts charged. Now, back in 79, for those listening who might not remember the days of what's called double system 16-millimeter film with a Nagra running with a crystal sink so that the cameraman and the audio guy always had to work together like a ballet team, because there was a cord, and the cord went between the camera and the Nagra with the crystal sink if you didn't have that, or those guys ever got separated, or that plug got pulled, you had no way to sync up audio and picture.
Right.
But what kept us going was we had to have battery belts that the cameraman and or, depending on the situation, the audio guy, wore these battery belts that kept the camera and the Nagra running. So when he said they couldn't keep the battery belts running, for me, a producer, writer, director, editor, my entire livelihood depended upon whether or not I could produce effectively in the field all of this work that I was doing. The battery belts were like beyond gold and platinum to us. So he really got my attention. And I said, well, what do you think was the problem? He said, we never figured it out. We think it was one of the spookiest location sites we've ever been on. And he said, I don't know what they're going to do with it, but he said it was so weird. So I said, well, do you have any idea how much did they shoot and when are they going to broadcast? And he said, we shot over 100,000 feet of film. Now, back then, that was as astounding as somebody today saying they shot 150 hours of video. Mm-hmm. It was expensive. No one shot over 100 hours on anything. So I decided, out of curiosity, more about the batteries than anything else, I would call, as director of special projects at the CBS station, the executive producer on the new 2020 series, introduce myself, explain the story, and say, what's happening? What happened on the battery belts, and when are you going to broadcast? And I did all this.
Let me just ask you, before this, did you have any impact?
I'll just finish this thought out and then and then come back, because this is so important what happened. So I've got the executive producer on the phone, and I ask him about the broadcast, and he said, oh, no, we scrubbed that. And I said, you scrubbed it? My audio guy said, you shot over 100,000 feet of film. Yeah, but we're in the business of news, and we could never come up with a hard answer, so we scrubbed it. And that, the idea that the ABC network in New York would scrub over 100,000 feet of double system film on a mystery where a trusted audio guy could not keep batteries going in the field is what made me do the film A Strange Harvest.
But before that, did you have any interest or any awareness of UFOs or any anomalous type of experiences?
No. This was what my moment of walking through Alice in Wonderland's mirror, where I set out and thought that maybe I was getting into an environmental contamination story. Maybe the government had secret crews that were out trying to sample animals, and they didn't want public panic because of something like the Dugway Proving Ground sheep deaths from all the nerve poisoning in the 60s, all of that. I had no idea. And when I began going to sheriff's offices for the very first time without a camera crew, this is just me, producer, writer, director, editor, trying to get my feet on the ground of a very strange mystery, and going and talking with sheriffs and deputies about what it was they had been dealing with, it was the sheriffs who said to me, Linda, the perpetrators are creatures from outer space. And I would say, look, I've got to do a project for television here. Would you stand up in front of my camera and tell me that? And over again, I would get, no, I'm telling you what is doing this, but I'm not going to be the one who stands up in front of a TV camera and gets ridiculed. I was in a kind of schizophrenic situation where the body of physical evidence of the animals that I began seeing and going with a crew, and then taking the information, taking tissue, taking hair, taking soil, taking plants, and going to scientists and finding anomaly after anomaly, just to give you an idea, because this leads up to the whole issue of self-activating software and self-activating machines. When I would go out into the field with formalin, take a scalpel or a knife, and I would collect tissue. And I would collect tissue that would be very clear and identified as the mutilator's excision. Then there would be Linda Howe's excision, And then I would make sure that I had a piece that was away from the mutilator's cut as a baseline. So all these were tagged, labeled, and I was FedExing to a hematologist, pathologist who was willing to work with me in Denver. And his name was John Altshuler. God rest his soul. He died about a decade ago. But during this period of time in the 80s into the early 90s, he helped so much. And one day he said, look, I've become so curious. I can't find any carbon residue on any of the tissue excisions that are identified as the mutilator's cuts. And he said, I'm finding evidence, though, that the hemoglobin is cooked, the collagen is cooked. So what is the instrument? And he had me come over to his lab, and he had one of these stereo microscopes so that you could look at the slides on one side and the other for comparison. He said, the one on the left are slides that I have gotten from a colleague who does laser surgery in gynecology, and you can see with your eye, describe for me what you're looking at in the excision. And I said, well, it looks like a lot of black pepper grains. He said, that's right. We're all a carbon-based life form. It doesn't matter whether you take a laser to a horse, to a cow, to a human, to anything. You're going to end up under a microscope seeing carbon residue. But now, he said, look over on the right and look at the mutilation, the excision that was there that had been prepared in a photographic slide. And it had none. And I went through about 20 or 30 slide comparisons with him that day. And he said, Linda, it's very puzzling. What is the cutting instrument that has the ability to cook the hemoglobin and cook the collagen and does not leave carbon residue? That gives you one insight into one of the mysteries. There's hundreds. And eventually, when I ended up producing and putting on the air, it was a two-hour special, A Strange Harvest, on May 25th, 1980. It was what I had found among ranchers, fellow journalists, deputies, sheriffs, what physical evidence I had been able to bring to bear. And it was broadcast. It got the largest rating that the station had ever received before or after for a locally produced documentary. It was a 19 rating and a 37 share back then in Arbitron and Nielsen. And why I say that is it was a huge audience that tuned in, followed by the largest delivery of mail and phone calls to the station ever. They couldn't keep up with the phone calls, and the mail was being delivered in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces every day in big gray bags to my office. And those letters and those phone calls were, I've never told anyone this before. And then I would hear somebody who had seen with their own eyes a beam coming down of a sphere of light in the sky, seeing an animal lowered to the ground or an animal raised to the ground, or helicopters that were completely silent hovering over their pasture that dissolved into a cloud, or a cloud that dissolved into a helicopter, and on and on. And I realized that in the 9 months that I had worked on A Strange Harvest, I was only really scratching the tip of the iceberg, and that the global, all the communication I was getting from around the world was reinforcing this phenomena was global. It was as exactly as the sheriffs and deputies had said. It was associated with phenomena that we would say was in the non-human category. And I had a very interesting event happen with the general manager of the station.
What was the station again that played this?
The CBS affiliate in Denver, Colorado in 1980 was KMGH-TV, Channel 7. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was director of special projects for several years. And mm-hmm. that's where I produced this. And after all of this with mail, and I mean, it was huge, and I'm saying, wow, I've got to do something more. I have to keep doing this. The general manager, who I had known, he had flown with me back to New York when I was nominated for a national Emmy, and I was in one of those New York TV programs. He knew me, And he respected my work, and I got a phone call. He said, Linda, can you come up to my office? And I went up there, and he looked serious, and he said, looking at me straight in the eyes, eye to eye, he said, I know that you want to continue following up on your documentary, A Strange Harvest, on these animal mutilations and the link to extraterrestrials. But he said, I'm here to tell you, you can't do it anymore because we will lose sponsors. Mm-hmm. And he did not explain who is sitting on him. He just said, there will be no more. It put me instantly into a horrible bind as a TV producer and as an investigative reporter. I have done something that has provoked more commotion from the world than anything that had ever happened at Channel 7. And now the general manager is saying, you can't keep doing it because we're going to lose sponsors. Today, I look back and think, I wonder if it was actually more serious. I wonder if it was something that was his excuse to me. But I just wonder if somebody from the government went to him and said, you can't let her do this anymore, because I ran into the same problem 2 years later when I was trying to produce an hour for Home Box Office. They had asked me, based on my work in A Strange Harvest, and that brought me face-to-face with the United States government. And all of this evolving through animal mutilations to human abductions and the government knowledge that is clearly there that we are not alone in the universe. And then you get into the late, what would be the late 80s, and crop formations begin showing up in England. And I was producing television and films throughout all this period of time, but had left Channel 7 in a couple of years, largely because it was uncomfortable to realize that you're in a station where you've done something that is really pulling the surface off of a gigantic hidden government knowledge and a policy of denial, and that your station is going along with somebody squeezing them and saying your award-winning journalist can't go on this anymore. And eventually, when I got into crop formations, I had done some work at CNN, and then I was hired to be the senior producer for what became the Sighting series on Fox. And I produced the first hour pilot that aired in October of, I think it was 1992, and 91 or 92. And In that process, we focused on what was happening not only in England but around the world. A lot of people forget this, that the so-called Doug and Dave explanation that was trotted out to the world was phony as the weather balloon was in Roswell. And the truth was that while we were working on the pilot for Sightings in Los Angeles, we were getting news, photographs, and video from 23 countries in the world that summer that were reporting very complex patterns, and that included one that is in my mind right now that was in Japan in a wet rice paddy, and it was a complex pictogram in Japan along with 22 other countries, not just in England. And 2020 and various TV shows were reporting about this amazing phenomena, and I ended up going over there several years in a row. And what began to impress upon me, as well as others who spent a lot of time in the crop formations and looking at aerials and working with scientists, it was the scientists who started saying to me early on, Linda, I think there's mathematical language embedded in these crop formations. And it was in, I think it was the second year that I had gone over to England, I think it was 1993, a man crossed my path in one of the formations, almost as if he did it on purpose, and a complete stranger, and he started up a conversation with me, and he said, look, I have some pretty solid information from the Central Intelligence Agency somebody I know there. He may have been talking about himself and was deferring and deflecting it to some other source. Who knows? But he said, I do know for a fact that the Central Intelligence Agency is working with the NSA, and they are using satellites to try to photograph every crop formation on the planet and put it in sequence as they arrive so that there's a timeline, and they are analyzing these because, he says, my understanding that their hypothesis is that this is the work of time travelers and that these crop formation patterns are being placed on the surface of this planet to monitor how effective they are in something they are trying to do with manipulating timelines. Now, in 1993, when this man told that to me in England, I didn't have much of a context to listen to somebody say those startling words. Now, in 2011, because of much more that I've been exposed to from people in the human abduction syndrome and come to the work of Michio Kaku. He is one of the best, I would say, articulate scientists. His specialty is string theory and quantum physics. But when he begins to talk about the fact that the vectors of time in the math of quantum physics can go either forward or backward, there's no mathematical restriction, and that if there are more advanced civilizations, he calls us a zero civilization, and that he takes it up to a three or four, and they would be able to even interact with suns and control weather and do all of that, he describes the ability that it would make more sense that time travel, the ability to move point to point in this cosmos in ways that we don't understand, would be what he would expect from advanced civilizations. What is not answered in that hypothesis is, why would time travelers be specifically using the skin of the Earth in cereal crops and grasses to place markers? Why would the Earth be involved, and why would no one be explaining it to us? Mm-hmm. Well, then we come to the whole issue of self-activating software and self-activating machines. I have been exposed to a document with photographs, with a lot of actually astonishing text, that allegedly was produced in 1984 from a laboratory in Palo Alto, California. And for any listener who is sophisticated about where our government has placed some of their more important labs for back engineering of anything or development, Palo Alto, the home of Stanford University, where I did my graduate work, is one of the paramount places not only in the United States but the world. So the fact that a scientist leaks a document with photographs to me and a couple of others about this being a real research project with no, there was no fishing around. This was straightforward back engineering extraterrestrial technologies to try to get the technologies placed in American corporations that would patent them to keep the artifacts out of the hands of any perceived enemies. And that these technologies included being able to neutralize gravity, project three-dimensional holograms in which any human seeing the projected hologram would not know the difference between the environment that they were walking in or living in and a projected hologram. It would be that good. And other abilities, and the kicker, the document, the leaked document with the photographs of these extraterrestrial artifacts that I have done many reports at my news website, earthfiles.com, about since I received this document in 2007, June. I have done about 25 reports related to subjects that are at the heart of this leaked document. And when you go into the document, and in the context of the work I was doing in 2007 about unusual aerial phenomena in the sky that were being photographed and had very strange symbols on them, and then in the leaked document from the Palo Alto Carrot Lab from 1984 are diagrams that are very similar to what were on the strange aerial phenomena of 2007 and can be found in whole or part over the last 35 years of crop formations. Mm-hmm. And that led me to, and that the whole point of the laboratory leaked report is that they began to, in an astonished way, to discover it was the symbols in a very meticulous, precise relationship that was responsible for all of the work, the tasks of the strange, dark, solid, extraterrestrial artifacts that had no moving parts, but could do thousands of astonishing acts, such as neutralize gravity and project holograms. And they began to catch on that there were symbols placed on the surfaces of these dark, glassy, solid, extraterrestrial objects. And they began to realize that where we are in a world that still must have hardware, a computer, a processor, we have to have all of this stuff that interfaces between software and us in order to do anything. And in one of the communications to me in a private email, the scientist and I had email communication before he finally said he was too threatened and disappeared. But he said the closest analogy that he could bring to try to help this understanding of self-activating software and machines is this. If you pick up a piece of paper from a desk and it's blank, nothing is going to happen to that piece of paper unless you physically put it into a typewriter, into a fax machine, into a computer that's paper that would get processed through all of the steps that it would take in a computer. And then you could end up with text that you've typed with your fingers, and it's gone into some format that ends up on this white piece of paper. And then if you want this delivered to Joe Smith across town, it either has to be couriered or faxed or emailed or another physical transmission. He said, imagine that all you have to do is to think of the piece of paper rising from a desk, putting everything that you are thinking about onto it in whatever font, size, diagram that you want. It executes by itself, will move through the air to wherever it understands that it is now to go, and you have never touched it and you will never touch it again unless you need to, because it will continue to self-activate with every impression and every thought until there is an end point to discussion, to creation, and that piece of paper can fold itself up and put itself in a file.
Mm-hmm. So this, okay.
Now, just before we leave that thought that I just left, imagine what are the implications if the crop formation patterns in two hemispheres for the last 30-some years are somebody else's self-activating software related to time travel for an agenda that none of us understand.
But you're saying there is an endpoint that will be approached at some point. There'll be some kind of a finale to the design of the software. Or if you can hypothesize the possibilities, what would you guess? I know it's not science, but you're putting all this together into a package, into an understanding that you must have your own conclusions about.
No. What I have seen in audiences, since this is the first year I've ever presented this overview with about 150 images and video and audio and all of that, and the thing about it is that people stand up and scream, "Oh my God! Oh my God!" And it's the same feeling. You begin to realize that over history, everything has remained like there's a light in the sky, a painting in France with a disc, the old wood types and archetypes, the stories from ancient civilizations about other intelligences, whether you're talking about the Mayan or whether you're talking about the Aztecs and Kukulkan. All of that has been in ancient history, but it has always been treated as mythology. Mm-hmm. And when you jump up to 2011 and you're dealing with all of these various pieces that I have been sort of skimming over the surface, and you begin to realize that the non-human interaction with this planet is probably millennia long, has always involved genetic harvests for an application that is not clear, and that symbols, the symbology, the so-called sacred geometry that has always been sort of at the root and the heart of secret societies throughout history, throughout modern human history of the last 5,000 years, that it could very well be related to the same large box of non-human intelligences from other dimensions, other timelines, another solar system in this universe or another universe that are using and interacting with this planet in ways that are incomprehensible to the human mind. But we're beginning to see the pattern. We're beginning to see that there is a 2 + 2 = 4 in all of these disparate pieces. It doesn't give us the answer why. But,
so let me just understand and digest that you're saying, and what I'm getting is you're saying symbols or the ways these symbols are being used in crop circles, and I've been to the fields of England, are sort of like, I would say, circuit boards. They're not just pretty designs. They're not just things that can be interpreted, but the symbols themselves are I guess,
doing work.
Yeah, but it's like a circuit, it's like a board inside a computer that puts together things that then activate something that we don't know. But the forms themselves are beyond the design sort of impact environments and realities to activate, let's say, like an evolution here or a shift in perspective, the way a circuit board would when you put in different circuits or transformers. These symbols are very much along those lines. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying.
Right.
Is that?
I think you're grasping the concept, and I wish that I could give a firm, definitive, solid answer to who, what, and why. But the very fact that the question is now being raised, is this that I'm raising, is it possible that the crop formation patterns have been functioning without humans understanding anything? They've just been doing the work that they were designed to do as self-activating software toward an end we do not understand in a process that is incomprehensible.
Well, that would make sense because a lot of times crop circles have been discovered that no one has really seen, and it's discovered sometimes days or weeks later. And most people think, oh, they're here for us to look at, and we're supposed to take those designs in and do something. I mean, some people think that. But I always wondered, why would these crop circles be made if no one saw them? If you know, and sometimes
right.
Perhaps they're made and no one has seen them. We'll never know, but I think there has. And even, you know, Charles Fort reported similar formations on the sides of hills. And you just, on your website, Earth Files,
right.
found a formation in the desert in China, Tibet, China.
Well, that turned out to be a car commercial for BMW, they deliberately put it out on the web. I ended up finally talking with one of the managers in Beijing after trying for three or four different nights to track these people down during my night and their morning. That whole thing was a BMW commercial, trying to see how many people would take it seriously, and it would be free advertising for BMW through the web. That's what they did.
But let me
just say something really, really important here, because you're raising this whole question of patterns on the surface of the Earth or even underwater that have occurred that a lot of people have never been aware of. And I did a news story just a couple of months ago about there being a very bizarre pattern under the water, quite deep, off of an area around Denmark and Finland. And I've never gotten a straight answer. I've tried to communicate with the people who found it. I think they're very uncomfortable. They don't have explanations. It's very odd. But this goes to another very interesting firsthand report to me from a pilot about 10 years ago. He said, I had been up in the very northern Arctic territory. I am flying back down to go to Fairbanks. He said, I am over Arctic, where it goes from Arctic tundra starting to go into forests. And he said, listen, there's nothing. We're talking about millions of square acres of nothing there except the raw land and the forest. And he said, all of a sudden, I see a circle, a perfect circle. It is embedded in thick, thick forest. And he said it was, I estimated, based on the environment, that the circle was about 100 feet in diameter, and it was defined in some way by the trees. He said, his camera was not accessible. He never expected he would see anything. He kicked himself. He said, if I had my camera was accessible, I'm telling you, I wanted you to know, here was this large, perfect circle completely embedded in thick forest up where the tundra becomes forest in northern Canada. Now, those are the kinds of stories that, to me, it really impress upon me the whole issue that none of this is actually being made for humans. It has another purpose.
I did want to address the idea that some formations seem to have an interactive quality, like the Pi Formation in 2008. And there was the 888 Formation. It was an obvious reference to the date, August 8, 2008. And there was a huge eight or infinity symbol in the field. So some of it's explainable from what you just presented, that yes, we humans don't have to see them, and in many cases perhaps don't see these formations. But in other formations, there seems to be some type of need for humans to see these crop circles. So,
or that the phenomena on purpose is just provoking humans to see who pays attention, who gets it, and who is working against it.
Mm-hmm. So taking all this, if you can hypothesize a conclusion for these self-activating machines and a sort of an endpoint, because something seems to be building on planet Earth. There seems to be an evolution, an acceleration, an endpoint, a finale that we seem to be arriving at that is accelerating to an nth degree, earthquakes, hurricanes. I mean, we've always had that, but it seems like, you know, we are building to a climax. And what do you think this will come about, if you agree with that?
Well, you're describing an increase in chaos on the planet, and I certainly see that. I think everybody senses that there is a feeling of agitation from the planet to humans, and the climate, and everything seems more of everything. And some people argue it's because the population is going to be 7 billion in just another 10 years or something, and the whole planet is in a kind of strange, I guess you'd say agitated vibration. with all these humans doing everything that they're doing and the exponential increase in the population of humans will continue unless there is something that stops the progression of humanity on the planet. And on the flip side of that question is, how could humanity continue in a kind of mindless tromping on the earth as it is doing now without killing ourselves? How would the planet be able to sustain the growing population in its madness to level mountains and trees and the Amazon? I just heard recently the Amazon is becoming more drought-stricken more rapidly than any scientist anywhere has ever projected out of global climate change. And they left the question, if in 100 years the Amazon in northern Brazil is gone, what happens to this planet? These are all legitimate scientific questions that are being presented to us now, and it comes to the root of your what you have just posed. Mm-hmm. If in 100 years, if you go back from 2011 to 1911, I don't think that the world was very unrecognizable between 1911 and 2011. It looked pretty much the same with areas of deterioration and desolation caused by the increasing weather changing patterns. But if in another 100 years that the vast majority of marine life is extinct, the Amazon is gone, what happens even to the very fragile atmosphere of Earth that the current carbon-based life forms must have enough oxygen in order to live? Mm-hmm. And we are facing the possibility that the atmosphere and everything is going to continue changing so rapidly. Are we at a point of self-induced extinction? And are there intelligences out there in other dimensions or this universe or others who actually care whether or not the Homo sapien experiment survives? So, and maybe what we are coming up and we're all beginning to feel is that we could be reaching a time in which there is going to be some kind of a time slip, time branch, something in which maybe one version of Earth will keep going and another version will not. And maybe we're dealing with advanced intelligences who are trying to manipulate time to save us from ourselves. And those are all, at one level, philosophical questions. And as we come up against December 2012, hanging there is another physical piece that is, to me, provocative, and that is that 5,125-year round, huge, heavy stone calendar that something in the Mayan civilization, and I say something because I think that they were inspired by and cohabited with non-humans, and that whatever that big stone round spiral calendar is and the obsession of the Mayans with astronomy, with the orbit of Venus, and with math, the very fact that winter solstice 2012, about 1 year from now, is the so-called closeout or end of that gigantic 5,125 stone calendar should make us wonder, if nothing else, why is it closing out on that winter solstice? And some people hypothesize it's because the non-humans who inspired the Mayans and taught the Mayans know that we are in a universe of cycles, constant cycles, and that something is going to occur from December 2012 onward that will be the beginning of a new cycle. How that would play out, I don't know. I'm not afraid of it at all. I'm extremely curious, but I do not split hairs. I do not try to qualify the statement that I've heard from military and intelligence people over the last 31 years, since I started trying to get to the bottom of the animal mutilations, and that is, yes, Linda, there are extraterrestrial biological entities. There's more than one type, and we still don't know exactly who they are and what they want.
Okay, let me put some of that together that you just talked about. So if we take the environmental chaos that's going on and the sort of possibility of the endpoint for humanity or a global climate collapse or shift, and then we take the other thing you said, which was there seems to be these time travelers creating on the Earth a self-activating machine. Are you saying, and I'm maybe making this part up, are you saying the time travelers from the future saw one possibility of the Earth's environmental collapse, planted these symbols as an ongoing kind of process as we get to 2012 to move us into a new timeline that will save the Earth in one dimension and help humanity evolve to its cosmic awakening because of this intervention from the future using these symbols and the Earth as a canvas? Is that what you're...
That is, Alan, that is an excellent summary. And a couple of things. The issue of non-humans far into the future trying to survive and that our survival is linked to their survival has been described in the human abduction syndrome for at least 30 years, including the staff sergeant Jim Peniston in the RAF Bentwaters, which I will also be weaving into this in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you go back again to the sort of the whole question of who, what, and why, the one common theme that I think almost everybody who has become experienced in crop formations over a long period of time would agree is that there is this sense out of the crop formations that life is not guaranteed on this planet.
Where do you get that from in the crop circle?
Oh, it's come up over and over again. The solar systems from mid-90s, there were many, many solar systems that appeared over a course of 2 or 3 years, and everything would be recognizable in the solar system except the Earth would not be there.
Oh, I see. Yes, I have seen that formation.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And that was one of the big, big philosophical discussions for 2 or 3 years about are we dealing with advanced intelligences who are trying through communication through the skin of the Earth to let us know that something could be coming up in the future in which the Earth will not be here, all life has extinction. And what you've just summarized, and I'm so thrilled, Alan, that you were able to make such a summary from my still trying to skim so quickly over so much tonight, right, is that my own sense, after all of this time and all that I've been exposed to and all the places that I have walked on this planet and the people in military and intelligence that have communicated with me largely only off the record, is that something that is far in the future, that Michio Kaku would say is completely possible, is trying to survive, and that what happens on this planet may be part of their survival effort, and therefore we are linked, past, present, and future, whether we realize it or not. Past, present, and future are entangled. And we are entangled with something else that has the ability to come and go on this planet, work with formations and patterns around the planet, and is interacting with beam technology, with humans, with animals, with plants, with water, with soil, and that I'm not certain our government or the British government or the Russian government or the Chinese government or any of them actually know what it's all about.
No, they don't know what it's all about.
But going as a reporter, Alan, this is what keeps me going. There's no question that it all is there and they are real phenomena, but who or what is behind it all, and what if our survival is linked to what they're doing?
Yes, I agree, but the contradiction of that is if they exist in the future, then we did survive, and you know, then their survival is insured, unless you accept the idea of parallel timelines, and they could be witnessing many lines where humanity didn't survive and it did collapse. So,
Alan, that's exactly what my 12-part series in Earth Files this year of a man who's a detective in Washington that I call Joshua Reinhall at his request. It's not his real name.
Right.
And he has had interactions with non-humans and draws these amazing illustrations of what he was shown in a holographic projection on a craft about how the beings who had him there manipulate timelines in order to affect past, present, and future in a lot of complex ways, in a lot of planets, a lot of dimensions, a lot of timelines, as if it's all so much more complicated than what we think about living our daily life here on this planet, and that when you begin to contemplate the 12-part series of Joshua Reinhall, you begin to realize that if his insight with another intelligence is true, then we can't guarantee at all, not at all, what the future of this planet is going to be, because it is still fluid and being affected by advanced intelligences who are trying to change the timeline.
Right, but Linda, one thing is that consciousness is itself, and this is my theory, is multidimensional. If you study with people like Richard Bartlett and Matrix Energetics, he has people shift timelines within this course through the power of their own mind. And he does these sort of manipulations sort of in space, and they come back and have miraculous healings. We've been conditioned and brainwashed and dumbed down to believe we're not these multidimensional beings. And those aliens have the same capacity we do, or we have the same capacity they do, but we've been conditioned not to realize it. So if anything is possible, if 2012 is a reality, it's the awakening of humanity to their multidimensional conscious self, that we are can be in full control of these timeline realities. That's my theory.
And the practical application to all of our lives is everyone is sort of having a mirror held up. Where would you like to be on December 21st to 22nd, 2012, if you thought it was a dimensional leap, the end of time, the Earth will no longer be here? I'm not saying these are realities. I'm raising the philosophical questions that the contemplation of winter solstice 2012 from the old Mayan calendar are raising these issues. And when you begin asking yourself and other people those questions, I find it the answers are fascinating. Some people are not even aware of the Mayan calendar or anything about December 2012, as much as some of us have been exposed to it and wonder. So we have a huge population on this planet that are completely unconscious about any of it.
Well, that's why these, I would say the spiritually minded, or those investigating consciousness, are making at least a dent into the mainstream. But people like Terrence McKenna, do you know his Time Wave Zero?
I was at a conference with Terrence McKenna long ago.
So he said the ineffable, which is casting its shadow back through time, and the movement towards a brand new future will be December 21st, 2012. He said at that point, history will be history, which means all the patterns of the past will resolve themselves and humanity will take a new direction, because he thought perhaps time travelers will have activated a new point within the consciousness of humanity. So ETs are one thing, and of course many people know that they're there, but to know that we exist, past, present, and future, and that time is all happening at once, this is a new reality that perhaps is unfolding that's way beyond what most right. people can consider. But people like you and my program and others are at least speaking the possibility, and it has to do with consciousness and sentience. The ability to be aware of our awareness is already a kind of transition in time. It's already taking us to an overview that's not possible if we just think we're linear beings going from here to there. That's my...
Right. Very good, Alan. And I think that you and all your listeners and my listeners and viewers and everyone who are really struggling, trying to understand, that we all know there is no possibility that the Earth with humans on it, acting the way humanity is right now, could survive humanity. Something right. has to change.
Well, it is changing. And you know that 2012 date also, according to Robert Lawler, synchronizes with the end of the Kali Yuga. It synchronizes with a connection within the Hebrew calendar. There's many links to the Aquarian Age, as it's been called. I mean, not that specific date, but there's something in Egypt that, yes, Jose Agüeyes, who really was the first person to pinpoint that date, said that that cycle began with the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, which he called the beginning of the myth of progress. Like we were on this wave of going somewhere where when we return to that point, we realize it's all here. The kind of Maya, the illusion of building a technology that is we think is greater than us will be seen for what it is, that the greatest technology is life itself, the organic flux of nature, which the ETs are after, I feel, in their abduction. They can create everything. They can change the weather, but they can't create the life that genetically is in us. And this is where I think, you know, we'll be returning to the basic fundamental appreciation of life itself. That's what I feel.
We need it. We should be cherishing the pura vida, as the Spanish would say, the spirit of life in all life. We should be cherishing it. And why are we on a planet where everything has to eat something else and there's so much war?
Well, why don't we do another show before you come to New York? I mean, or maybe more than one more show.
Or do one after New York, because then you will have seen my presentation, and then we could discuss it from your very refined intelligence after.
Well, thank you. I mean, but I do want, I mean, I would love to do one after, but I think what we're at, we've just really scratched the surface of your research. There's the... If you go to Linda Moltenhau's website, earthfiles.com, there's years of your research, but just some of the headlines are the, let's see, I'm just looking what you sent me, the U.S. government.
Everything from astronomy, which is science, to environment. I'm working on something on Fukushima right now that's absolutely amazing. And then there are the real X-Files. And I put everything that I can't say I have hard proof for, but that we all need to be considering the leaked documents, the leaked military voices, the leaked intelligence voices, and they are in a big Real X-Files section at Earth Files. So I'm trying to put those in the context of science and environment because they are real.
Well, there's also the common LNR updates, LNN updates. There's the DNA building blocks. There's the New Zealand abduction and the alien pyramids. There's so much. If you have some time before now and October 22nd, I'd love to cover some of more. It's been really fascinating. Well, first, listening to your story and hearing the evolution of your awakening. You know, you come as a reporter, steeped in science, and then it's one revelation after another that just opens your eyes until you're really at the edge of the human mystery here.
That's right. And it really is and has been my life since September of 1979 has been almost a perpetual walk of Alice through that mirror. Because on the other side of the mirror, when I come up to September of 79, I had what would be considered a normal human life as a TV producer and a writer. And I go into animal mutilations, and I've never stopped going through Alice's mirror. And when you think it's been 31 years of still trying to get answers, and I've gotten a lot, and I keep sharing what I do learn, but that this is so complex, so multi-leveled, pushing at the very edges of every piece of quantum physics that's available today and beyond, then you know, Alan, that you're in the presence of something that is truly beyond the human mind.
Well, it is beyond the human mind, but only the limited mind that we've been conditioned to have. I think we are possible. We can possibly comprehend this mystery. And I think some of the great masters have. And I think that's what 2012 marks, is the coming into a galactic awareness. If December 21st means nothing else, it means... It points the way that our connection is to the center of the galaxy. That's the alignment with the center of the galaxy, with the sun and the earth. So it makes us aware of our galactic presence. So that's an opening. That's a Copernican revolution in a way. But we have to wrap up, Linda, and thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Alan, for your intelligent program and trying to reach an audience with some of this complexity. Thank you very much.
Well, this is the kind of stuff I really am excited about, and I really appreciate your research and your thinking about it, and you're stepping outside the box to consider new possibilities and new realities. It's really what I'm looking for, is exactly the kind of work you're doing. So again, I've been talking to Linda Moulton Howe. She will be in New York at the Friends of the Institute of Noetic Science Conference. That's FIONS, F-I-O-N-S, October 22nd, along with Whitley Strieber and Richard Dolan, both very frequent guests on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. And they'll be speaking at from 1 to 5 on that day. And you can check that out on the FIONS.org website. And Linda will be covering a lot of the work she mentioned here, ETs, time travels, crop circles. So I'm looking forward to the slideshow aspect of this presentation, Linda.
And I'm looking forward to your feedback, Alan.
Okay. And I'll talk to you soon. Definitely.
Okay. And all right. God bless everybody, no matter what.
Okay, thank you, Linda.
Take care.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to hear this program again, you can go to the BBSradio.com website. It'll also be posted on newrealities.com. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions or comments about anything you've heard here tonight, I'm very interested. Please email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening. And this is Into the Fire by Green Fire.
Waking up in the middle of the day feels like a dream.